for President Trump's decision to kill Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani with an airstrike in Iraq, some members of Congress raised concerns about not being consulted ahead of time. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine has since introduced a war powers resolution that would limit the president's ability to authorize military action against Iran. His bill has at least some Republican support in the Senate. While the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, the reality of who can approve the use of force and what steps they have to take to do so is a bit more complicated. Jennifer Daskal is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, the Constitution, as I mentioned, gives Congress the power to declare war. But have we seen the balance between the president and Congress change over the years, putting more power in the hands of the White House?
So absolutely. So we have over time, we have seen a kind of an incremental shift in which the executive increasingly engages in a range of exercises of the use of force without getting advance congressional authorization. We've also seen ways in which old authorizations, in particular the 2001 authorization that was passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, and the 2002 authorization that in which Congress gave its blessing to the executive to engage in force in Iraq in an effort to oust Saddam Hussein, have been interpreted and expanded over time by the executive to authorize the use of force against groups that didn't even exist at the time that these authorizations were first enacted. And we've seen Congress acquiesce in a lot of ways to that kind of incremental expansion of executive action in this regard.
Has this been a bipartisan movement? If I'm a Democratic president, I want this authority. If I'm a Republican president, I also want this authority?
So we've seen broad assertions of executive authority to engage in actions by both Republicans and by Democrats. What's different here is, and what's different from the ways in which, in particular, the 2001 and 2002 authorizations to use force were interpreted by both the Bush administration and the Obama administration and now the Trump administration to go against kind of groups that were deemed to be affiliated or successors to al-Qaeda, which all arguably, through at least some theory of interpretation, could be tied to the 2001 authorization to use military force. What's different here is that the president has engaged in the use of force against a leader of a nation state in a situation in which there is, among other things, has been a real risk of escalation without first going to Congress to try to get authorization with respect to the killing of Soleimani.
Have we seen precedent for that kind of action, use of force against a foreign leader without specific or without any kind of authority from Congress?
So, I mean, the president, pursuant to the president's Article 2 authority, the president has, and I think it's well recognized, the president has the authority to take action, self-defensive actions, if, in fact, there were an imminent threat to U.S. troops or to U.S. persons. What is concerning and different here is that the self-defense justifications, although they were originally articulated by the Trump administration, have increasingly been discredited by a range of reporting that's come out since, including some suggestion that this has been, you know, something that's been considered and debated for quite some time, which belies the notion that the president didn't have time to go to Congress to try to get Congress's blessing in terms of its actions here.
And when we talk about congressional blessing, does that mean the president would have to get a full vote from both chambers of Congress for that kind of imminent but not immediately imminent action, or can they do it with a certain group of congressional leaders?
So in terms of getting an authorization to use military force, in terms of making the monumental decision to engage our troops in armed conflict, the president absolutely has to go to Congress. That's what or should go to Congress. That's what our Constitution says. It's Congress that declares war, and it's the president that executes it. In a situation that you posited where there's some sort of imminent threat and there's a credible risk, then the president can engage unilaterally, and there's an obligation under the War Powers Resolution that he then notify Congress, and there's been practice, kind of consistent practice, that the when possible, the president would at a minimum notify some what's known as the Gang of Eight or certain leaders in Congress as well.
Talking to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, looking at the use of military force and the conflict often between the president and Congress over authorization for that kind of use of force. Now, just over a week ago, the administration gave a briefing on the Soleimani killing to some senators. Republican Mike Lee of Utah, not happy with what he heard. Here's a bit of his response afterward.
Biggest thing that I found troubling from that briefing was the suggestion that, number one, they would discourage us from debating things like a War Powers Act resolution, and number two, their unwillingness to identify some point at which they would need to come to Congress to get authorization for the use of military force. I find that very troubling.
So from Senator Lee, his description of the briefing there, he's implying that the White House says they have open authority to do just about whatever they want without coming to Congress. Do you read his statement that way?
So I think what we've been hearing coming out of that briefing is that there was not a whole lot of specificity to support the claim that there was, in fact, a kind of imminent threat that would justify unilateral action. And you're starting to see some Republican senators join ranks with Democrats in saying that they will vote for a bill that would explicitly limit the president's authority to engage in the use of force against Iran without further congressional explicit authorization, with some exceptions, again, for situations in which the U.S. faces an imminent attack.
I want to give a listen to Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who's bringing up that bill you were talking about getting a little bit of Republican support. Here he is speaking on the Senate floor.
The demand for congressional accountability is constitutionally required. In the unique constitutional framework that we have, we pledge to support and defend the principle. It's up to Congress to declare war, not the president.
Is this the kind of thing that Congress has to do if it wants to have a meaningful say in potential military future action against Iran?
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely encouraging that Congress is now engaging. There was a resolution that passed the House. Is different than the bill that's in the Senate, because the resolution that passed the House is something known as a concurrent resolution that just has to get passed by both chambers, but it doesn't get sent up to the president, which means that it almost certainly does not have the force of law. What Senator Kaine is pushing is a bill that would then require signature by the president. That, of course, however, raises the reality that there's a significant almost certain likelihood of veto by the president. And at this point, at least, it doesn't appear as if they have a veto-proof majority in this particular case.
We're talking to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, about the powers of the president to wage military action and the ability of Congress to restrict that action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what each branch is legally able to do and not do? Are you worried that the U.S. president has too much leeway in using military force? Should Congress play a bigger role than it does in situations like the one with Iran? Do you support this binding resolution we were talking about in the Senate that would limit the ability of the administration to take military action against Iran? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the war powers of Congress and the president with Jennifer Daskal, professor of law at American University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's an imbalance in who has the power to approve military force and bring the country closer to war? Should Congress have a bigger role, or is it right for the president to have a lot of leeway? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some of you on Facebook. Janice says the founding fathers didn't want a rogue president to have that power. Jennifer, can you talk about the Constitution and what kind of limits it hoped to put on a president when it came to the ability to declare war and to take military action?
Right. So that's exactly right. So the Constitution makes the war powers a divided set of powers between Congress and the executive. And reflecting the idea that such a monumental decision to go to war is something that should be made not just by the executive, but by the branch of government that represents and is closest to the people. And so that's why the Constitution says that the Congress should declare war and the president, the executive, can execute war. Now, everybody also acknowledges that the executive can and should take actions in self-defense when there is a necessity to do so to protect the U.S. and the U.S.'s national security and U.S. troops. Over time, that understanding of when the president can act unilaterally has expanded from what was originally presumably conceived of as part of the Constitution and acted upon in our earlier history.
Yeah, along those lines, Larry on Facebook writes, presidents should be able to react to a fluid and fast-changing situation. If we're talking about an 18th century war where a country would have to mobilize an army and so forth, that's one thing. Nuclear war, the Cold War, presidents might have to act and make a decision within minutes. Did that drive some changes in this constitutional balance and laws passed in Congress?
So the constitutional balance is the same. Congress still is given the responsibility to declare war. What's happened over time, particularly in the last almost two decades since the September 11th attacks, is that Congress did pass an authorization to use force, and over time the executive has relied on that authorization in to use force in ways that were not imagined by Congress when Congress first passed the use of force, because it's using force against groups and entities that didn't exist at the time of the 2001 authorization. So we've seen kind of an aggrandizement in that way, and Congress failing to step in to try to take any steps to curtail that kind of executive decision making. On the other set of issues with respect to the president's ability to engage in self-defense actions, that's always been understood as an element of the commander-in-chief, the executive's authority. But we have seen over time, broader assertions of what kinds of actions the president is entitled to engage in unilaterally.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Yes, hello. I wanted to bring up that basically the deficiency in our system of government is that the Senate Majority Leader, as long as that leader is in lockstep with the president can pretty much do whatever he chooses or she chooses, unilaterally decide, because no resolution or law that comes onto the floor of the Senate will even be acted upon or brought up for discussion unless that Senate Majority Leader decides it. And if that same leader of the Senate is in lockstep with the RNC or the DNC, whichever the case may be, between those three individuals, no senator will challenge the Senate Majority Leader.
Mike, thanks for the call. Do you see, Jennifer, partisan politics getting in the way of Congress asserting its oversight role here?
So in this case, there is a mechanism to bring Senator Kaine's bill to a vote, and it will likely happen. I think there's some complications with the fact that the Senate's now, as of today, embroiled in an impeachment trial, but there's been a commitment that there will be a vote on the bill. The problem here is that the president will almost certainly veto it. And so the issue is not just the majority leader, but getting to a veto-proof majority, which requires two-thirds of the Senate.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go now to Sherry in Portage. Sherry, hi.
Oh, hi. Well, I just had a question when I was listening you said that there was no threat when President Trump took the initiative to have this man killed, but nobody is saying why he was in Iraq and what he was doing in Iraq. And it kind of brings back the whole Benghazi thing, that we knew there was a threat there and we didn't act. And there was a lot of U.S. military that did get killed and citizens that did get killed. So,
Sherry, thanks for the call. I want to jump in just a minute or so left with our guest. Jennifer, the argument, and we've heard indications from the White House, they say at least Soleimani was involved in potentially imminent attacks.
Right. So, I mean, a couple of things. One, we know that Soleimani was dangerous. He was a dangerous individual, and he was engaged in a whole range of disturbing actions. That said, the question here is not whether Iran posed kind of a grander threat, because in those situations, that's exactly when the executive should go to Congress and ask for an authorization if, in fact, there is a decision to use force against Iranian forces. The issue is whether or not there was, in fact, the kind of imminent threat that would justify and the president to use force in this way without going to Congress. And then there's a separate set of questions and separate about engagement internationally as well. And here we initially heard some claims by the executive that there was an imminent threat. And over time, those don't appear to be backed up. And in the briefing to the Senate, that has led to some Republicans joining support for a bill that would restrict the use of force against Iran.
And we'll watch the progress of that bill. Thanks to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, looking at military power, the use of military force, Congress, and the president. More people are being locked up in Wisconsin, and the increase in inmates in the state's jails and prisons is costing taxpayers more money. A new analysis of state data by WPR found significant increases in jail populations since 2015. Rob Menser has details.
During a recent tour of the Oneida County Jail, a man who'd just been booked was there coming down from the drugs he'd been using. Jail staff had him in restraints, and the man could be heard calling out.
Let's head this way first. On something. They're keeping a close eye on that.
It's not rare for people who get booked in the jail to have medical needs. Jails have become used to dealing with people who are facing withdrawals from opiates or the lingering effects of methamphetamines. Oneida County Sheriff Grady Hartman says dealing with the effects of drug addiction has become the norm.
4 or 5 years ago, I never really thought we would have, our community up here in the Northwoods would have a lot of methamphetamine and heroin use. I never thought we would have overdose deaths.
The increase in inmate population has put a strain on many local jails. The number of jails placing inmates in other counties has been steadily rising in recent years. In the first half of last year, more than 40 jails typically had inmates in other facilities.
We built the facility in 98, and then in 2009, we started to outgrow the facility.
That's Sheboygan County Sheriff Corey Raisler talking about Sheboygan's detention center. It regularly exceeds its recommended population of inmates, and that can force some difficult decisions.
We just don't have enough single-cell space in order to accommodate those needs when people come in off the street and they're under the influence of some intoxicant or drug, or they might have a medical and mental health issue, but which would preclude them from being placed in the general population.
During a tour, Brinkman says some of those inmates do end up housed with others in a less secure area of the jail.
And this area of the facility fills up faster than we'd like it to, so we're forced.
Governor Tony Evers campaigned on a promise to cut the state's prison population in half. A report from the state showed that it grew by about 8% from 2011 to 2018. Reversing that trend was always going to be a challenge, and there's little evidence of progress. In fact, state prisons are so overloaded that the state regularly pays county jails to take inmates. Oneida County, which has more space than it needs in its detention facility, contracts with the state to take about 100 prisoners at a time. time. Sheriff Hartman says Oneida County officials drive a four-hour round trip from Rhinelander to Stanley, Wisconsin, every week to exchange inmates. But he says in many ways, the state prisoners are easier to manage.
As headaches go with inmates, we have significantly far less headaches with a state inmate than we do with a county inmate.
The county also earns about $1.2 million per year from the state in exchange for providing housing. The money goes to the county's capital budget. Legislative efforts to reduce the jail population haven't gained steam in the state capital. But Milwaukee Democratic Representative David Crowley is one of a group of legislators focused on the issue. He's introduced a bill to limit bail jumping charges, which are used to incarcerate someone who's violated a court order, for example, drinking alcohol if a judge has ordered them not to, as a separate case proceeds through the court system. In 2018, more than 8,000 people in Wisconsin were charged with felony bail jumping. Crowley says someone can be found not guilty of the original charge, but still be prosecuted for violating an order like that.
But because you were guilty of bail jumping, now you're doing even more time than the original charge.
Crowley's proposal has bipartisan support, but it's not clear that will be enough to get it a vote. Earlier this month, Governor Evers called a set of Democratic proposals a first step toward criminal justice reform. The next day, a group of Republicans announced a legislative package they called, quote, tougher on crime initiatives. Those bills would increase some penalties. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an age discrimination case is before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll look at the current state of affairs when it comes to age-based discrimination in the workplace. Add some Korean flavors to your home cooking. We'll find out how on this week's edition of Food Friday. And it's the future today in a Wisconsin college class that's using cutting-edge virtual reality technology. Is it the cyberpunk world come to life? Probably not. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.